So how do we know a good idea is really a good idea for First Nations children and families? Or that that good idea actually works in the diverse and distinct First Nations communities all over this country? Let's dig a little deeper and chat with experts in the field of child well-being about what the evidence says, what are some of the myths, and what works when it comes to supporting First Nations children, young people, and their families. You're listening to Season 2 of Spirit Bear's Ask an Expert podcast. Welcome, everyone, to Spirit Bear's podcast. Yes, that's PAW, P-A-W-D, cast. And we are coming to you from unceded and unsurrendered Algonquin territory today. And so blessed and honored to have a very special guest and friend of the Caring Society and friend of First Nations children, Dr. Helena Gaspard, with us today to talk about the research that's going to be coming up on Jordan's Principle. We need to come out there to communities and find out what your experiences are and what is working, maybe what questions you might have that haven't been answered, but also some of the things that maybe need a course correction. So that's coming up soon. But Dr. Gaspard is director of the Governance and Institutions at something called the Institute for Fiscal Studies and Democracy, IFSD, everyone. That's what it is. That's the short form. And Helena is a researcher. She's an advisor. She's a teacher, a convener. And her work focuses on government institutions that incentivize and govern the behavior of different groups. Sometimes that's those groups involve First Nations children or those delivering services to First Nations children. She has an honors Bachelor of Arts degree from Western University, a Master's of the Arts from Queen's University, and a PhD from the University of Ottawa. Helena, we are so delighted that you're joining us today. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Cindy. Thanks for having me, and always a pleasure.
And for everyone, you need to get out and look at their website, ifsd.ca. Do I have that right?
You've got it, Cindy.
All right. And you're going to find all kinds of different reports, not only on Jordan's Principle, but on the work that you've been doing with First Nations communities and with those who are working with children on child and family services, right?
Absolutely. So we've been really privileged for the last 5 years to have been working with First Nations and Child and Family Services agencies on the ground, and we've learned so much from them. And so we've done our best to capture everything they've helped us learn, everything they've helped us understand. And we bring our little tool set to the table, and we put those pieces together in the hopes of building out and defining structures that better support the needs of kids.
Yeah, and this work, everybody, is so important. I don't know, if for everyone's info, we just got the decision from the tribunal yesterday on compensation, where they have approved $23.4 billion in compensation to all the children, young people, and families that were harmed by Canada's discriminatory provision of child and family services in Jordan's Principle. That provides some measure of justice, but the work you're doing, Helena, is about, in my view, one of the most important elements of justice, and that is these survivors went through what they went through and told their truth so that no other child would ever have to go through with it. And that's what you've done on CFS, Child and Family Services. There's me using an acronym. And that's what we're going to talk today about on Jordan's Principle, because Jordan's Principle is about part of this Canadian Human Rights Tribunal case. And just for our listeners to know, we always like to begin by paying honor to Jordan River Anderson from Norway House Cree Nation. Jordan was born in a Winnipeg hospital. He had to stay there for 2 years, medically required, but shortly after his second birthday, he would have gone home. But because he was a First Nations child, the Government of Canada and Manitoba, they argued over everything related to his at-home care. I want to make this very clear. If he was non-Indigenous, he would have left a hospital. But because he was First Nations and because these arguments about money went before his well-being, they left him in hospital. And as his sister, Jerlene Anderson, says, he died of a broken heart just before the age of 5. Now, the family have courageously created Jordan's Principle, which ensures that First Nations kids get the help they need when they need it. Government adopted it in a House of Commons in 2007, and after the fanfare, they did nothing. And so it was only when the tribunal ordered Jordan's Principle to be enforced that we started to see government change. I'm just going to put in one little language tip for people. Sometimes we hear people shortening Jordan's Principle to JP. We're going to ask you not to do that. It's a recognition of Jordan every time we mention his name, so always use the full form. So let's launch into this exciting work that you're about to get underway. So can you give us an overview of the research that you've done looking at the department's data on Jordan's principle? And what were some of the highlights that you found out of that?
We had an opportunity to look at the data that Indigenous Services Canada was capturing up to 2020-2021 on Jordan's principle. And one of the most striking things for us, Cindy, was the increase in the number of requests. We first started, we had access to data, good data that started in 2017-18. And between 2017-18 and 2020-2021, there was a 625% increase.
Wow. So for 3 years, 625% increase.
Over that entire spectrum, 625% increase in the number of requests. And so when we look at just the last two fiscal years of data, that number of requests on its own goes up by 50%.
Wow.
That for us is significant when we think about it from a public finance perspective, because that means that people have real needs, that they're going to Jordan's principle to meet these needs. And so that also for us signals or makes us think about what other gaps might exist in the system, right? Jordan's principle is so important for First Nations children, but at its core, it was meant to be almost a last resort for exceptional circumstances. But what we're seeing from the data is that sometimes Jordan's principle seems to be the first place that people might seek support or recourse. And that for us makes us think about all of the other parts of the system that might not be meeting the needs of First Nations children.
Right. And so, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if we look at the types of requests coming forward, it's largely in education, in medical transportation, and mental health supports. And those areas we've known from parliamentary budget officer reports and reports of the Auditor General have been seriously underfunded as well by the federal government. So Jordan's principle may well be plugging those other underfunded programs. And so people are trying to get support for their kids that they deserve, that other Canadians would likely receive as a matter of course, but they're doing it through Jordan's principle, and that leads to that big increase. That's one of the theories.
Absolutely. And it's a really important point too, Cindy, that while there's a lot more information that's being gathered about Jordan's principle by Indigenous Services Canada, that on its own is helpful. But part of the challenge is that we don't know why children are going to Jordan's principle in the first place. So from the information, we can see, just like you're explaining, tags on education or medical transportation, but we don't know why the child went to Jordan's principle in the first place. Was it because this is a chronic condition? Was it because the parents simply couldn't afford it? Was it because they live in a really remote place and it makes it tough to access services when they need them, so they needed extra help to get there or to be able to bring, you know, the right people to support them? That's the kind of information that we think would be really helpful moving forward to help ensure that Jordan's principle can keep meeting the needs of children.
Right. So everyone listening, for Jordan's principle, you need a letter from a professional, a relevant professional. So if I wanted learning supports, that might be from my child's teacher, or if I needed medical things, it might be from a nurse practitioner or a doctor. But what you're getting at there is that there's a difference between equality, which is treating everybody the same, and then what's called substantive equality, which is giving everyone the same chance to succeed. There's a couple ways of explaining substantive equality. And one of the best ways I've heard is kind of the baseball analogy, that you're born on third base and thought you hit a triple, where somebody else is actually right at the batter's thing and having to make the rounds. You know, we want every kid in this country, to, no matter where they're starting from, to have the same opportunities to succeed. And that's what substantive equality is. And that's what the tribunal has ordered Canada to do with Jordan's principle. So we need to know, exactly to your question, why are children doing it? Is it because of these other programs are underfunded by Canada? Is it because of legacies of other types of programming decisions? We don't know at this point.
That's well said. And part of it is these, I mean, Jordan's principle and all of the other work that the Caring Society and, you know, AFN and others have done over the last few years is really premised on the well-being of children. And that well-being never comes from a single place or a single issue or, you know, a single item, right? It's about so many different things that a lot of other Canadians will take for granted, right? We think about adequate and suitable housing or water or even access to a really good school. And when we think, too, about wellness overall in our community, so if people around us are struggling and you're a kid, it makes it really hard sometimes to move forward or to get ahead. And so part of what we try to think about when we're thinking about Jordan's principle or substantive equality or all of these ideas is, how do you help kids succeed on their terms based on where they're starting from? And that's something that we try to keep in mind in our work when we ask the question, what's your starting point? And in the work going forward on Jordan's principle, we're asking not only what's the starting point of First Nations children, but also really importantly, what's the starting point for Jordan's principle as a system, if you will? And it's not to, you know, when we're talking about it as a system, we're not discounting the importance of Jordan's principle or what it does for children, but we're actually trying to understand it as a set of rules that shape how people react and how people behave in a system. And that for us is really important, because if Jordan's principle is intended to meet needs on the ground, we have to understand how Jordan's principle operates. And when we look at it from the outside, sometimes it's really tough to understand how some of those decisions are made and what some of those steps might be along the way. We know the broad ones, we know the general ones, that's really helpful. But we also have to try to better understand what it means for people on the ground. What's it like to access Jordan's principle? What's it like if you're a professional, or what is it like if you're a navigator or a coordinator? What can we learn from all of the people that are involved in Jordan's principle to find ways of making it better?
Yeah, and that's really essential, right? Is to take that view of, if you're a child or a parent trying to access help through Jordan's principle, what does it look like? That, to me, is the real area where we should measure all systems from. And too often it's done, we'll see in news announcements, particularly by different government parties, oh, well, we've done all this stuff. But that doesn't matter if you're one of those people for whom the system doesn't work. And we really, there are some serious concerns with Jordan's principle. I mean, we look at what the tribunal has required Canada to do so far. First of all, for all of our listeners, if you have a child who's in an urgent circumstance, what that means is, you know, your child can't wait. Something bad might happen to them if they don't get this service ASAP, or if the child is in palliative care or end of life care. Every second there is sacred. So those are urgent cases, and the department should be responding to those within 12 hours. Sometimes that's not happening. Even if it's not urgent, if you have a child, because kids only get one childhood, we know how fast things change for them. So they have to have their case determined within 48 hours in the government. That's what the tribunal has ordered. For group requests, it's 48 hours if it's an urgent one and 7 days if it's not urgent. So we need to see what the compliance is with those timeframes. And the reason we're focusing on compliance is because if you're one of those children in urgent circumstance and your needs don't get met, by definition, it means that you've suffered some harm. And we don't want to see that kind of stuff happening. So that's part of what we'll be looking at is the system now 7 years out from the decision? So this is a time when they should have a well-oiled machine going here. Is the system being able to accomplish that? If it's not, then why is it? Are they wrapping these requests up in too much red tape? Is it a question of how the financial systems go? Like, what is getting in the way of success for every kid?
From our perspective, we're trying to address it exactly as you're saying, by looking at both views, if you will, of Jordan's principle. The view from the ground. How are people that are interacting with Jordan's principle engaging? What are their perspectives on how it works, what doesn't, what could be better? Also, too, how it connects in with communities and with other community organizations. And then also taking that top-down perspective, as you're saying, what do we see when we look at federal data? What do we see when we hopefully speak to folks in the regions that are managing Indigenous Services Canada's portions of Jordan's principle? So it's about putting those perspectives together to help better understand what's happening now, but also how Jordan's principle can continue to do the important work that it does moving forward.
Okay, great. And just for everybody, can you let us know the title of that report? It has all that good information on Jordan's principle.
Yes, the very long technical name is a data assessment and framing of an analysis of substantive equality through the application of Jordan's principle. And that report in full is available on IFSD's website, and we can also make sure the link is included with the podcast notes.
All right, that sounds good. That is a long thing, but really what it is, folks out there, is looking at the information the department collects and is saying, what's happening with Jordan's principle? Now, you mentioned that skyrocketing increase, 625% over 3 years and then an additional 50% over the following 2 years. Some people might say, Dr. Gaspard, that's due to COVID-19. What do you have to say about that?
Well, we asked ourselves that very same question to try to understand that 50% increase in those last two fiscal years for which we had data. And as it turns out, when we looked at requests that were flagged with COVID-19, they didn't make up at all the bulk of the requests. It was actually just a minority of requests. I think it was just about 10% in fiscal year 2020-21 that actually had to do with COVID. So it wasn't COVID that was driving that 50% increase.
And 2021, well, that was in the worst of the lockdowns all across the country when there were no vaccines and scientists didn't actually know what we were dealing with in the early stages then. Another thing that kind of struck me from that report is people think that these requests must be for tens of thousands of dollars, but you found something different in your research. Can you help us share with us what that was?
It was really striking for us. It was actually the costs of the requests or the requested amounts that were coming through. The vast majority were actually for items less than $5,000. And just about roughly 40% over the last two fiscal years for which we had data were actually much lower than that and were actually under $1,000. And so that to us says something about the nature of products and services that are probably being sought. The vast majority of these requests appear from the outside not to be for complex medical interventions or complex needs. They're probably more likely than not basic products, basic services. You know, you mentioned that education and medical transportation came up as the most frequently requested categories. So, you know, I'm sure those in community can probably guess what types of products and services would have been related. Anything from maybe, you know, gear for school or, you know, a trip to a hospital, you know, those sorts of things are what we saw come out of the data. Really small and frequent requests.
Yeah. And, you know, taking a 35,000 foot view of that, you know, we're talking about small amounts of money that can make a huge amount of difference for a child and a family. And sometimes what we found in the case is that government was reluctant to spend those small amounts, and then they end up paying far more downstream. And this is backed up by research by James Heckman, who is a Nobel winning economist out of the University of Chicago, who found that when you make these investments, they're good quality investments recommended by professionals, that you can save as much as $18 US for every dollar you invest in those early things. And this is a real lesson for governments, right? They need to understand that kids are the very best investment of tax dollars. You don't get that kind of return by investing in someone my age, right? But too many of these government programs are geared towards those of us who are further down the age continuum and for which there isn't a great return on investment.
It's such a helpful point that you raise. We know from all kinds of literature, economics, public health, global public health, early learning and childcare, the earlier you can intervene and the earlier you can invest, the better off kids are over the long term. And absolutely, that short-term investment, that return that you're talking about, that's there. But over the long term, there are broader societal community benefits. You know, young people tend to do better. They finish school, they get jobs, they stay out of jail. They do all of those things that, from a broader societal perspective, put a lot of pressure on costs, on services, on all kinds of other community considerations. So that's why for us, investing early and supporting kids in their formative years ends up being, you know, again, from a fiscal perspective, the best value for money, the best way to support kids.
Yeah, you know, like I'd like to see data, and maybe this is something you'll come to in your upcoming research, is not just how much Jordan's principle costs, but how much Jordan's principle saves. You know, like anybody out there knows that if you have a leaky roof, you might as well get it patched up right now, because if you don't, then you're going to be spending a lot of money down line. Well, that's exactly the situation with kids. So we want to make the smartest use out of the money that we have, and investing in kids when they need it is the way to do that.
Absolutely. And we're hopeful, too, that we'll get to a point with Jordan's principle where there will be a much better understanding of what children need now, where children are starting from, how they do over the longer term, and also, too, importantly, starting to better identify where some of those gaps around them might be. So it's not only Jordan's principle that's, you know, the recourse, mm-hmm. but that overall things are better for kids.
Yeah. Like, I mean, why would you need to kind of use Jordan's principle to access water? Like, why don't the kids just have water as a matter of course? I mean, this is ridiculous. We people say, oh, well, it's too complicated to get water to First Nations. But I always say, look, we have clean water and excellent high-speed broadband in the space station, Population 6. We definitely can get it out there to these communities that need it. You know, this work that you're doing on Jordan's principle, you and your entire team, along with something called the National Advisory Committee, which are some First Nations colleagues who are just amazingly skilled. So I just want to put a shout out to them. It's moving into this next phase. And can you explain to us what that's going to look like? What communities should be watching for?
Absolutely. So thanks to our good colleagues at the National Advisory Committee, we've pulled together a group of regional practitioners who work in Jordan's principle. And so they're going to work with us lockstep throughout the project to make sure that we have good participation from the regions, really good perspective of sometimes the differences, sometimes the similarities of how Jordan's principle operates, how Jordan's principle is delivered in different places. So what we would ask folks to do, and just a note as well, we know what we're good at IFSD, and we also know that children and families that have interacted with Jordan's principle have very special sacred stories that are theirs. We feel really privileged to be able to do the work, but we also recognize that there are people that are better suited than us to help receive some of those stories and support those families, those children, those parents, those caregivers in sharing them. And so IFSD's work is going to focus on the folks who are, say, working in professional capacities in Jordan's principle, in First Nations, in regional organizations, you know, hopefully with, you know, Indigenous Services Canada nationally and regionally as well. And so we hope that people will help us understand how Jordan's principle works, what's worked for them and what hasn't. And I think the best things to watch out for are to answer your regional, you know, your regional contacts, your regional representatives, if they're reaching out to you in the hopes of, you know, being able to capture the important stories and the important work that happens through Jordan's principle. So if you have recommendations of colleagues, of other professionals that have worked with or interacted with Jordan's principle that want to talk about their experience, please let them know that they can get in touch with us directly, of course, along with the work at the NAC and with this regional group of advisors that's working with us too.
And a shout out too to the folks at the grassroots level who are working as, sometimes they're called Jordan's principle navigators or coordinators, but they're there to work with families to access Jordan's principle. And those are the kinds of folks that you'll be wanting to speak with. And also some of the practitioners. We know the Canadian Pediatric Society, for example, has done a study of the experience of pediatricians in accessing Jordan's principle. That data should be available fairly soon to the public. All of those groups who have something to say about this has been our experience, and this is how we can make Jordan's principle even better for kids and families. Those are the kinds of folks that you need to hear from. Now, when are you going to be ready to kind of go out and talk to people?
We are planning to be out and speaking to folks probably in the fall. So we're actually meeting with our regional group in September. They're all joining us in Ottawa. And so that will be our launch.
Wow. So over the fall.
Over the fall and into the spring of 2024.
Okay, great. And I know that you are very familiar with visiting with First Nations communities all over the country, right?
Oh, yes. Small airplanes, remote, isolated, you name it. We have had the privilege of visiting and really experienced some incredible people doing really great things.
And I have to put a shout out to some of the First Nations restaurants out there, you know, and cafes and stuff like this. Like,
absolutely.
That's one of my favorite parts is just hanging around with a cup of coffee and just talking with people, right? And
absolutely.
People are just so generous and are really happy to be a part of change that is driven by a collective experience, by their own experience. And I think that's really important to what we're doing. One of the things I often think about, we have Jordan's baby blanket in our office. So people ask me often, they say, well, how do you think about Jordan's principle? And I said, well, it's sacred. That's what Jordan's principle is. Every time I walk by the baby blanket, I wonder what Jordan would think about what's happening today. What do you want Jordan to know about the work that you're undertaking?
Well, I hope that he would know that he has changed the lives of so many young people and that he has left a really important legacy that while he suffered, his suffering, I think, as sad and as unnecessary as it was, has helped thousands of other kids. And I can't imagine the pain that must have caused for his family, but hopefully, too, some solace in knowing that he's done so much for so many other kids. Sorry.
No, but that's the thing, Helena, is that I really think, and this is one of the things that I admire about your work, is I found that the best people working in this area fall in love with our kids. And I see that in the work that you do. It's not just a job. It's a passion. It's about a responsibility of co-creating a new world and honoring children like Jordan. And that's why it's so important that we do this work in such a good way. And that's why I'm so honored and privileged to work with you and with the other team members on doing this. So just one last kind of question to you. Is there anything that you'd like to share with people that maybe I missed?
We're really grateful for all of the contributions. And that's something that's absolutely critical for us in our work, making sure that we understand what's happening on the ground, because we're not there all of the time and we don't always see all of the nuances when we're looking at numbers or we're looking at mappings, right? So we need people to breathe life into what we see to help us make sense of it and to help us make sure we get to the best possible answer for kids.
Yeah, and some people might have some stuff in writing that they could just send by email, right?
Absolutely.
You know, and your email address is on the website, right?
On the website. They can reach out via email. And sometimes if folks like to chat about things by phone or Zoom, we're happy to do that too.
All right. Well, Helena, it's been a delight to have you here. We're going to have you back maybe midway through this this work, because we really want to keep people informed on what's going on and how they can be participants in this collective work for kids. That's always what made it successful, is having people from the community level involved in creating the solutions. Thank you so much for taking time out to join us today.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Always a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Spirit Bear's Ask an Expert podcast. Be sure to tune in for more episodes coming up where we'll do this all again and find out what works for kids. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at Caring Society or visit our website, fncaringsociety.com, where you can get all kinds of information about this topic and our future episodes.